The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, mindfulness of speaking. There is a saying that goes something like this. When meditating, watch your mind. When in the world, watch your speech. But it could also be, it may be said more kind of a different way, because some people would like to meditate and they don't. Some people, for some various reasons, can't meditate. So if you can't meditate, pay attention to why you say what you do. If you can't meditate, if you want to do kind of the next best thing, pay attention to what motivates your speech. Why do you say what you say? Because if you start really paying attention to why you say what you say, you'll learn a lot about yourself. And you'll be surprised by many of the motivations that are operating and concerns that are operating. And it becomes a door for kind of inner purification, inner, you know, discovery that's very effective. So speech is a very important part of human life. And I find it, I found it over my time as a mindfulness practitioner, one of the most difficult places to be mindful. It's a very easy to get caught up in the speech and be involved and not really pay careful attention. But it's also, I think, one of the most powerful places to pay attention carefully, as those little cliches maybe point out. And it's not just speech, but all forms of communication, all the ways in which we communicate with people. And we have now, more and more people who do a lot of their communication in disembodied ways. Back in the Buddha's time, I think most communication was very embodied. People basically talked to each other, and there were no books to read or newspapers to read or emails to do. So if there was going to be a communication between people, it for the most part had to be in the presence of people who actually spoke and listened. About a little over 20 years ago, I was invited to a small symposium at Stanford University where the Dalai Lama was going to be part of a panel to discuss ethics. And one of the questions the Dalai Lama was asked was the ethics of disembodied communication. And it was coming out of people who were becoming aware of the big, you know, advent of email and other forms of disembodied communication. And I don't remember very well what the Dalai Lama said in response. I don't know if he was prepared for the question back then. One of the things that I remember was he said, "Oh yeah, I know about that, because in our tradition we believe that there are beings who are made up of pure mind with no bodies." So, you know, that they're disembodied. And so maybe some of you are becoming celestial beings. But I was struck by but it's kind of stayed with me, this question of what's the ethics, what's the appropriate way, the right way of communicating. And then in the early 2000s, IMC had, late 90s, 2000s, we had some kind of, it was like maybe an email listserv that people could sign up for, and then people at IMC would communicate with each other and about things. And it became quickly apparent that we needed someone to monitor it and kind of not allow things to be posted until it had been read. And because not everything that was said there was appropriate, to say it lightly. And some of it was actually, there were some things that were actually quite mean. And this was the IMC community. It was kind of surprising. So eventually we stopped having that. It just didn't seem like it was, somehow it didn't seem to work well enough. The So the Buddha gave a lot of teachings on embodied communication, on speaking. And one of them that, and there's a number of lists of things, but some of what he gave was guidelines for how to consider what you're going to speak and the criteria for speaking. And he also gave guidelines or ethical teachings about what not to do. And it's easy to kind of list those things and talk about them, and it could sound like a should, like this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do, and it becomes kind of like a rule-based approach to how we speak, which has its place for sure. But when people meditate or have an inner life, then there's a possibility of what guides us in our communication, in our actions with each other in this world, is not be so rule-based so much, but to be based on an inner reference point, an inner kind of standard that lives in oneself. And so, for example, if your heart is at ease, then you'll notice if you are about to say something, hopefully you'll notice that you're getting agitated. And that's a very interesting reference point. And then you can ask yourself, do I really want to give up the heart's ease for this agitation? What's so important to say here? Is this really more important to get agitated and say this than it is to keep my ease and find a different way of communicating? If the heart, inner life, the quality of the inner life is one of love, of compassion or caring, then if we really know that and feel that and are in touch with it, that becomes a reference point. And then if we're going to say something that's mean or not loving, and we feel that that's contracting, we feel like in the process of doing that, we're going to lose some of that loving quality of the inner life, then you can ask yourself the question, is this worth it? Is this appropriate? Do I want to do this? Is this, you know, if the inner life feels somehow a certain kind of sense of integrity or purity that is there, and you feel that what you're going to say is going to lose your integrity or lose a sense of being whole or have some kind of ethical purity, and that ethical purity, integrity really feels delicious, feels sweet, feels, you know, intimate and, you know, really feels like a home. Do you want to lose that home? Do you want to darken it or close it up or you know, what kind of impact you have on it? So it becomes a very different reference point than a rule-based. And then what happens when you start having these lists of teachings of how to, you know, that Buddha gives, the more rules or the ideas, then rather than seeing them as rules, they can be seen as mirrors or reminders to, let me pay more careful attention here. What's happening inside? Am I about to lose something that's precious and valuable? Is this what I want to do? And then this inner reference point might actually be a guide where it becomes clear how you want to live your life. You don't want to lose that. Not only for your own sake, but because in your connection to other people, the connections are so much richer or more meaningful if you can come from this when the inner quality of life is in a good place. So in terms of what not to do, the Buddha gave a list of four things, and which sounds like, you know, ethical precepts. But he called them, he didn't actually call them precepts or commandments or rules. He called them skillful actions. He put them in the category of skillful things to do. And in my kind of modern translation of it, I kind of like to call it healthy things, or healthy things to, you know, things to avoid in a healthy way. So the first is not to lie. The second is not to have malicious speech, so speech which is going to harm. The third is not to have harsh speech. Maybe it's not meant to harm, but it comes out so harsh that it's actually hard for people to listen to. And the third is not gossip, no gossip. And an interesting ancient teaching in Buddhism is that it's easier to stop lying than it is to stop having malicious or harsh speech. And it's easier to stop having malicious and harsh speech than it is to gossip. Now, I don't know if that's true. But I find it kind of fascinating that someone in the ancient world thought that way. And what is it about gossip that pulls us or grabs us in a way that it's more difficult to drop it than to lie or something like that? It's interesting to consider. And so not to lie, and the little cliche that supports that is that if you don't lie, you have less you have to remember. Because once you lie, you kind of have to remember it, keep it going. And so it just makes life easier. And so the principle of a life that's more easeful and easy to live is certainly one of the reference points we can have for this, how we want to live our lives. When he talked, when the Buddha talked about not lying, he suggested that people, that one speak the truth, adhere to the truth, and be trustworthy and reliable and not deceive the world. And then there's malicious speech, which is, one of the central kind of principles of Buddhism, Buddhist ethics, is not to harm. Just that is like the principle, the core principle, don't cause harm. And if you go in and look into the, if you have a higher inner quality of heart or mind, or, you feel settled, peaceful, at ease, warm, connected to the world in a nice way, it's very hard. Well, you'll see that when we harm others, we're harming ourselves. If we're not connected to ourselves in a deep way, we tend to focus on the object of our concern, to have an impact or what we want or something. And so then it could be, there can be good kind of, there can be strong arguments for it's okay to harm, maybe. But if you're really in touch in here, you realize that you're harming yourself. If you don't get blinded to what's going on here, if you include yourself as the mindfulness, then you harm yourself. And sometimes it's the speaker who is harmed more than the recipient. Some people, they just shrug their shoulders, and they don't. It just bounces off them. And so the Buddha once, there was a man who was angry at the Buddha, so he came to the Buddha and was angry at him for something. And the Buddha listened, and then he said to him, "If someone came to your house and brought you a gift, and you didn't accept the gift, who does that object belong to?" And the man said, "Well, then it belongs to me. Then it belongs to that person. I didn't receive it, so it still belongs to the person. In the same way, I don't accept your anger. It belongs to you." so you're the one who's, smoldering and, suffering with it all. So the idea that sometimes it can feel, really justified or self-righteously right to be angry and to attack people or be resentful. And the question is, who's being harmed the most? And I've known people who've had resentment for years, and the pivot or the key that helped them to drop their resentment was when they realized that they've been smoldering for years, but the person they were resentful for probably didn't even remember who they were. that person, wasn't having any effect on them. And so, it was kind of, why kind of keep having this sense of hostility? So, avoiding malicious speech that's going to harm. The way that's defined by the Buddha, it's speech which divides people, so that it creates division, separation, or animosity between people. In addition to just hurting other people, there's also hurting society, hurting other individuals by how we treat other people and speak about other people, and is it going to divide people against people? And rather than malicious speech, the opposite is that one reunites those who are divided and promotes friendships, and brings about concord. So that's nice. So again, it's nice. In principle, it's kind of nice not to divide people and have people become enemies, but rather bring people together and create concord, create unity between people. It's nice. But then if you use this inner reference point, you know, and people who meditate keep coming back to hear this reference point, not because we're self-absorbed or, you know, conceited or self-centered. It's actually, it's the inner reference point that's the antidote to selfishness, because it's a place of freedom or ease or not being contracted around self. So we come back here so we can be turned inside out and returned to the world with a much better place, so we can live what we're feeling inside, what we know inside. And it feels so much better for the inner life to be involved in promoting friendships and concord and harmony and unite people. It just makes the heart sing in a way that, you know, if, you know, I got them, you know, angry at each other, it doesn't. Abandoning harsh speech. One speaks words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. So, you know, what are the motivations people have for harsh speech? I think a fair number of times when people have harsh speech, they're hurting inside. And so they haven't attended to their hearts, to their inner life. They haven't attended to their hurt. They haven't found a healthy and appropriate way to live with hurt. But, you know, so they recoil from it, they react from it, and so they're kind of, you know, ready to attack and be harsh and be bitter rather than something else. And thinking about this today, I don't know if this is exactly to the point, but I'm touched by this little story that I have no idea if it's true, but I like it. So I say, once upon a time, there was a young boy of maybe 7 or 8 years old who came home from school really late one day. And he was supposed to be home earlier and came home, and the mother was upset. He said, "How could you have come? You knew you were supposed to be home earlier and we were waiting for you, and, you know, where were you?" And the boy said, "Well, my friend Billy, his bicycle broke. And I stayed to help him." And the mother, who was still kind of upset, said, "You don't know anything about fixing bicycles." And he said, "Yeah, I don't know anything about fixing bicycles. But it felt important to stay with him while he was crying." So suddenly that context of everything changes, right? You know, the mother's angry, but how could you be angry after that? You know, like that. So to have harsh speech, to have speech which is not thoughtful or caring, do we really know who we're talking to? Do we know the impact we have? Do we know what their struggles have been? Do we want to listen first before we speak this way? And then abandoning gossip. So one of the most common, seemed like in the last year or two, my impression is that one of the most common ethical challenges that people have come and talked to me about has been being at a work situation, you know, working with a, you know, some company, and the common currency around the coffee machine, or, you know, when people hang out, is to gossip. And people come to me, "I no longer want to gossip. However, it's really hard because that's how people talk to each other. I don't feel like I'm part of the scene, or I feel like I'm outside now. And, you know, this is a difficult thing." So sometimes gossip has functions. It brings people together. Sometimes people bond around gossip. Sometimes we bond because gossip is a way of sometimes of saying, "Look, we're better than those people. Can you believe what they did?" It's kind of like, you know, then I know better, you know, because I can judge it. And so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of builds up a certain kind of status, and it's nice you do it with someone else, so you kind of like, you know, feel good or feel like you're in the know or special. And sometimes it's a form of malicious speech, sometimes it's a way that causes harm. There's an ancient saying before this disembodied communication time, I guess, but that maybe it's really ancient saying from someone can gossip in Syria that kills someone in Rome. So, you know, gossip spreads, moves out. Another little teaching around speech, all these kinds of, you know, is that wrong speech is like an arrow, not like a sword. Because you can pull a sword out, and if it seems not needed, you can always put it back in its sheath. But once you've let an arrow go, you can't stop it anymore. So once you've spoken and the words are out, then you know the impact can be there. So those are kind of what not to do, and he kind of gives kind of opposite things. But then there's a wonderful list of five criteria for speaking. And I find these wonderful to keep close at hand, and when it seems necessary or important to consider what you're going to say, to have these so close that they're second nature. And you're ready to think about it and reflect on it and say, you know, and stop for a moment. Does it fit this criteria? So the first criteria is truth. Is it truthful what I'm going to say? The second, is it kind? Is it a kind thing to say? Friendly thing to say? The third is it useful? Is it beneficial? The fourth is, does it produce concord? Does it bring people together? Does it unite people? And the fifth, is it timely? Sometimes it's true, it's kind, its intention is to bring people together, and in principle it's useful, but it's really the wrong time. And so, you know, the compulsion to speak sometimes is so strong that we don't take into account that this is not the right time, the person's not ready, so be careful with the timing of it. Consider when is the best time to have effective communication with someone. Just because you feel compelled to speak doesn't mean that it's going to be effective communication. And then this thing about usefulness, is it useful to say? It might be true, it might be kind, and it might intend to bring people together, but is it useful? And sometimes some people are not going to... There are some people for whom we can say the truth, we can say what we think is necessary, but they're not going to change whatsoever. And then you could say there's no purpose in speaking to it. So why exhaust yourself? Why keep trying to knock on a door that never opens? And some people, some people are infuriated or feel really upset that what's true and kind and everything is not received. But that happens sometimes. So why go to the trouble to, when it's not going to be received? And this idea of, does it bring people together? And a very interesting area of attention is when you're speaking, the words you speak, do they bring people together? Is it more friendly? Is it more warmth? Is it more people feel connected? Or does it divide people? Or does it make everyone feel a little more uncomfortable? And, I remember a couple of weeks ago I was talking kind of idly with a group of people, and someone said something, and I introduced something which was not malicious, not false. It wasn't really harsh exactly. It was some little idea. There was kind of a footnote to what people are saying. But it turned out it was a little bit of a downer. And I said it, it didn't need to be said. And it had a little bit of a kind of dampen the whole mood of everyone. It wasn't, it was only for a moment, but I could feel like, and then, it all kind of picked up and recovered. But I said, Gil, I told to myself, Gil, you didn't need to say that. it wasn't useful, it didn't produce concord, or, you know, it wasn't contributing to anything that was useful. And it was, you know, it was just a footnote to reality that no one needed. And so is it truthful? Is it kind? Is it caring? Is it affectionate? Is it, you know, or not? Is it useful? Does it produce concord? And is it timely? And here again, rather than taking them as rules, how do these five guidelines relate to the quality of your inner life? There's opportunity with mindfulness practice when it's strong, and is to really keep relating it back to the quality of your inner life. One of the principles of Buddhism is that you're the only reliable custodian for the quality of your inner life. If you're looking for other people to be the custodian, if you want other people to behave in a certain way so that your inner life can feel good, you're a little bit, you know, in dangerous territory. And but a lot of people do that, you know, in codependency and expectation, or people who are, you know, if other people love me, then I'll feel good, or something. If other people approve me, then I'll feel good. If other people praise me, then I'll feel good inside. But you know, to give away responsibility for your own inner life is a very dangerous thing. It's a life that's not going to be very stable, or it's going to be fragile in many ways. And but to become the custodian of your own inner life and know how to maintain that inner life in a good way is one of the functions of this practice we do. And to discover within us a quality that's worth protecting or worth being. It's not always easy, but sometimes it's all we have is an intuition that there's something that resides in there, some kind of sense, oh yeah, there's a possibility, or once upon a time I knew something, or, you know, there's a, you know, or it's not all or nothing. It's like, you know, my quality of my inner life is not so good, but it's better today than it was yesterday. And the fact that it's better is better. And now Gail's been talking all this stuff, and now I'm supposed to, you know, and I think, well, I'm supposed to have this pristine, beautiful, pure inner quality, and now I really feel bad. I think better is sometimes better is good enough, and to appreciate that and to use the better as a standard is good enough also, because you see, well, it's better, it's not as good as maybe it could be, but it is a little bit better, or it's not as bad. And so then we use that and see what, you know, what do we do that moves us to worse, and what do we do that keeps not so bad? That's a beginning of this inner kind of work. And then we can slowly learn what's a better quality inside, and then we can learn to be a custodian of that. And since the world of our communication is so important, we communicate so much. How does being truthful, kind, useful in our speech, beneficial, creating concord and timely, how does that support us in the well-being of our heart? And, because it's a valid concern, how does that support the well-being of other people? How does it support the well-being of our society? And to ask these questions is equally valid when you're in the presence of somebody in an embodied way as it is when we're doing this disembodied communication thing. And I think our society needs to learn much more of that. It's kind of mind-boggling to me to, you know, when there's all these kind of responses to articles and things, and the amount of hostile comments that go on. And so to offer the opposite, to be an example of the opposite, for our sake and for the sake of others. And in doing that, in being careful with mindful speech, paying attention to all this, it is a cultivation, develop a mindfulness of attention, of being in the, being present to really track what's going on. And so the more we cultivate this presence and attention to what's here, we're developing mindfulness. As we develop mindfulness, we have greater access to the quality of the inner life, and that turns around and wants to support us in how we speak. And so it's a wonderful cycle, wonderful mutuality, that mindfulness supports right speech. Right speech supports mindfulness. And hopefully it just grows and develops for you, for all of us. So those are my thoughts for today. So we have time if you want to, in a truthful, kind, useful, concordly, and timely way, want to say something. Please. What does it say on your t-shirt?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What does it say on your t-shirt?
Oh, this is sushi. It's all sushi.
I asked because I kind of like that. Is that the Heart Sutra?
Yeah, it's got kanji, which is
yeah,
and then the English translation.
Yeah. So I don't know what if I said was useful or timely. So I'm already failed. So please.
I tend to make things complicated, and there's two things. One is I'm not sure what the definition of gossip is.
Of what?
The definition of gossip.
Yeah.
How it's, you know, what am I gossiping or what? Or the other thing is confronting, say, a bully.
Last word?
Confronting a bully.
Oh, yes.
If you know, it's, I, like I said, I complicate things. I think of the exceptions. And I'm just wondering what's a skillful way to do that, or does anybody have an idea how to confront bullies? And what is the definition of gossip?
Yeah, two questions. And I think of gossip as, I don't know, I don't have a good definition of it, but in my kind of idea is that it's unnecessary speech which talks about a third person in a way that's deleterious to that third person.
Even if he's a bully.
Even
if he's a bully.
Well, what's the purpose of speaking to it? So you're talking about a bully to someone else, and you're trying to figure out what to do and how to respond, or processing your own feelings so you can be wiser. It might be appropriate, provided that the person you're talking to is going to hold that in a way that's responsible or caring. Because sometimes, I mean, bullies should be addressed. Should be, you know, so talking that way. But if all we're doing is complaining, you know, and we're kind of bringing everyone else down from our complaining, and everyone feels discouraged hearing all this, is that really helpful? But to name it and talk about it that way, you know, and let's try to figure out what to do, or I need to process my feelings, that's good. And then bullies that we're encountering, if someone's being harmed in our presence, it's good if we could step up and be a support, stand next to the person, stand between the person and the bully, if you can. Try to do something, you know, that's that. I've told this story before. It's not exactly a bully, but I was living in San Francisco, and I don't know what to say, but it's certainly a dangerous part of town. And I was out in the street in the middle of the day, and this car came careening down the hill and screeched to the halt in the middle of the intersection. And from the back seat, this woman tumbled out of the car, kind of to get away, but she kind of stumbled into the intersection, and I was standing on the sidewalk. And these big, strong, tough-looking football kind of size guys came out of the front seats, and they clearly wanted to kind of somehow approach her, and she was wanted to get away from them. So what do I do? I didn't know what to do, but it seemed like this is not a good scene. So I went and stood between her and them. And, you know, I'm a little bit tall, right? But, like, I was looking up. I didn't know what to do, except if they took it, they kind of stopped and they took a step towards me. And with the wisdom I had, I took a step back. That's about all I, you know, I was like, where's this going to go? But I was standing there between her and them because it didn't seem this thing to be good. And then some other fellow came off the sidewalk and he walked up and he said, he kind of addressed them and said, if I was in her shoes, I wish that you would stop and help me. And everything de-escalated. That was the little trick. That got everything settled down. So were they bullies for her? Were they in danger for her? It wasn't clear. Even afterwards, it wasn't clear what was really going on. But here was someone else who stepped in and was able to, you know, figure out how to address it without violence and without having to be a fight or something like that. So I think, you know, and then if you're being bullied, you know, maybe that's a different you know, skill set to know what to do. And it depends how dangerous it is to know what to do and what can be done. And I think the criteria, like, is it useful to speak up or is it harmful? Sometimes it's better to just, you know, it's more harmful to address it than it is to walk away and lick our wounds later. Or is it useful? Do we have a way of usefully speaking up and saying, you know, that, you know, that's painful? And there was a man who came here into this building who was upset with me. It wasn't upset with me, but he was upset. There was work being done in our building, and the person was upset with how noisy the work was, and he marched up to me and was really angry and kind of, I don't know if it was a bully exactly, but really letting me have it. And I listened for a while, and when there was a chance for me to say something, I said to him, I looked him right in the eye and said, listening to all this, it's actually very painful for me. And as soon as I said that, his shoulders dropped, he relaxed, and he just pulled back, and then there was a whole different conversation, and it kind of came to an end. So that was useful. So does this address your concern adequately?
It pretty much does, yes. Thank you. I was just, I have issues with, did I act with courage or cowardice? And that's, you know, constantly bouncing in my mind. You know, was I courageous? Did I have courage or was I a coward?
Is there a prescription in Buddhism about how you deal with speech that is not following those rules, and at the interpersonal level, at the society level, and then at the level of politicians, what's going on in the country?
Well, I think those five criteria are the answer to that. You know, so if someone is not doing those things, is it useful? What is useful? What's a useful way of responding and dealing with that? There are people who are upset and insist that things have to be different, and their approach to try to criticize it or try to stop it is counterproductive. So the more it becomes into the public world in politics, I think the more skill and the more consideration of what actually is effective. I'm quite inspired by the example of Mahatma Gandhi, his salt march. Apparently, he spent a long time, I don't know how long, wondering what can he do to respond to the English Empire. and then he, after a lot of consideration, he said, the salt march. So he didn't do it impulsively the first thing and write a letter to the editor. You know, he thought about it and thought about it. So the more it enters into the public domain, I think, attention to what is actually useful and effective is part of that. And but those five criteria are still relevant. You know, so if someone is not living that way, are we going to speak truthfully, usefully? Are we going to be supportive? How are we going to do it? And sometimes that day of concord, we have to be a little bit sophisticated about it, because sometimes our intention is to create concord, but the other person is not going to respond that way. And so we still speak up, and sometimes it does create more division, but it's inevitable. But, you know, we know that that's not our intention, and no has to be said. You know, something has to stop. And so we put our, even sometimes our life on the line, because this can't continue. And so you might be interested to come back here on June 16th, a Saturday. We're going to have a wonderful man come in and a woman come and talk about Kingian nonviolence, the approach to nonviolent action that Martin Luther King Jr. developed for the United States. And and certainly that was one way of responding with some of these. I think it was a very ethical response to what goes on in the world, what Martin Luther King was developing. And I think there's a lot of guidelines there. So, one more.
You actually addressed my question, which was about saying no when it will, in the short term, produce discord. But it is the rest of the criteria.
Yeah, so I mean, it's possible to tell someone, I care about you, and I don't want us to be alienated from each other, but this can't continue. And if this continues, we can't talk, or if it continues, there's not going to be any more in this way. So that sometimes it's, you know, sad, but sometimes we have to make really strong lines. And but so I'll end with this. The Buddha developed a monastic community that had to live together, and that's always interesting. And so sometimes the monastics had to admonish each other. That was part of the deal. But here's the criteria for how to admonish skillfully. A monastic who desires to admonish another should do so after investigating in the following way. And after establishing these things, then they can speak. Am I one who practices purity of bodily action? So how do I act? Do I act in the world with some ethical integrity? Am I one who practices purity of speech? Do I speak in an ethically sound way? Maybe with these criteria. And then this is the one I think is most significant. Is my heart free of malice, and is it established in goodwill? So yes, there's sometimes we have to admonish someone or speak to someone or, you know, give feedback to someone. But you know, we have to look at how we are, how we're going to speak, how we behave. And are we doing it out of an ethical place, this inner resource place that of goodness? And then do we have loving kindness when we do it? But if we're doing it with resentment, with hostility, if we don't really think, don't have the other person's best interest in mind when we admonish them, I think it's counterproductive. Yes?
I need to make an announcement about temple cleaning.
Oh, okay. Here. So, we're done. For me, so I just want to end. Thank you. Very much.